From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later, Paula Harris joins us with a breaking story of giants and monsters. And in a moment, Brain Magic 2 and creativity from another dimension with Neil Slade. But here's what's happening. Sausages, ham, bacon, and other processed meats appear to increase the risk of dying young, according to a study of 500,000 people just released from Europe. It concluded that diets high in processed meats were linked to cardiovascular disease, cancer, and early deaths. The researchers, writing in the journal BMC Medicine, said salt and chemicals used to preserve the meat may damage health. There you go. Just tuck that away and use that. Well, some family members of victims killed in the 9/11 terror attack said that they are outraged by the Transportation Security Administration's decision to let passengers carry pocket knives on planes. The TSA administrator announced that the airline passengers will be able to carry pocket knives and blades less than 2.36 inches long and less than a half an inch wide. Souvenir baseball bats, golf clubs, and other sporting equipment also will be permitted starting next month. The agency said the policy aligns the U.S. with international standards and allows the TSA to concentrate on more serious safety issues. Now, Robert Young Pelton, of course, has become the inspiration and role model of a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He has been on the program numerous times as we talk about global war trends. And Robert's with us to react to this TSA decision. And Robert, you're a knife manufacturer. I want everybody to know that, right?
Yeah, I have a company called DPX Gear, and we make knives for special operations and special forces members. And we know the rules and the laws regarding knives pretty well.
You sure do. Now, tell me, what is your take on allowing these 2.36 inch knives on the planes in April?
Well, the first thing is, like anything that TSA does, it doesn't do it very well.
So
if you go to the site, what you'll see is that the knives that they're allowing on board are actually all European-made knives, like the old, you know, the Swiss Army knife and the Victorinox, which are very close to things like box cutters and the things that were actually used in 9/11. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. What their excuse is, for example, in Los Angeles, they confiscate 47 small knives every day on average. Is they're saying that this slows down the officers and they should be looking for explosives. Well, they're still going to be confiscating knives that are 2.38.
Yeah, I mean, are they going to be there with a little a ruler and measure all this? They're going to have to.
I guess so. And if you want to really fight over your, you know, $2 Swiss Army knife, it's going to eat up a lot of time. But they still confiscate things like tactical flashlights and pens. And if you can take a hockey stick on board a plane, I'm pretty sure that an entire hockey team could take down an airliner. So I don't know where they're going with this. And this thing about being in line, knives are still prohibited on European flights. So we would be the only country that would allow knives on flights.
What happens, Robert, one day if a terrorist is aboard a plane with one of these 2.36 inch knives, grabs a little baby or something like that, and it can be lethal. I mean, you cut the artery to the neck with anything, you're in trouble. And you know, threatens the cockpit and says, let me in, or this little kid dies. I mean, I can see that happening one day.
Well, let's just back up. Why do you need a pocket knife on a flight? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, so I, as a knife manufacturer, I don't see the need to carry a knife on an airplane. Secondly, if we're carrying hockey sticks and baseball bats, bring it on. I mean, you know, boxing gloves and
boomerangs
or whatever. So it just doesn't make sense. And it's the direct result of lobbying by the manufacturers of these types of little knives that were confiscated in such great numbers to sort of, I guess, appease that manufacturing sector.
That's a good point, too. The lobby is behind so many things, Robert. Well, here we go. It's gonna take effect April 25th. Hope to God nothing happens. We'll see what happens.
Well, I'm happy to comment on it, but in the meantime, you know, common sense is not their strongest suit.
No, not at all. Robert, thanks, and we look forward to getting you back for another show. NORAD, by the way, evacuated for 4.5 hours after very suspicious packages there. The NORAD headquarters in Colorado evacuated for 4.5 hours after employees found 5 suspicious packages, but the command's control room team was working at a backup location 8 miles away at the time, so nothing was disrupted. Employees became suspicious because something about the packages looked out of place. Tests performed on the packages ruled out chemical, biological, radiological agents. The packages were then removed. They're undergoing further tests so far. North Korea, something strange with these people. North Korea said it is scrapping all non-aggression pacts with South Korea, closing its hotline with Seoul, closing the crossing point between the two countries. The announcement follows a fresh round of UN sanctions against North Korea over its controversial nuclear program. North Korea is also vowing to use its right to a preemptive nuclear strike against its aggressors, which they say happens to be the United States, first and foremost, and South Korea. Jerry Corsi, who writes for WorldNet Daily and noted author and researcher. Jerry, eventually, somebody's going to have to do something about this.
Eventually. I think you're right, George. I mean, North Korea is on a war path. In December, North Korea launched a successful test of a three-stage long-range rocket. And then on February 12th, North Korea detonated a nuclear weapon that is viewed by experts as on the road to helping North Korea miniaturize a warhead. So North Korea is definitely developing a launchable nuclear weapon. It still could be years away from being a serious threat, but you can't discount the possibility that North Korea is crazy enough to try launching a missile at the United States just to see what would happen.
You know, Jerry, I take threats very seriously, always have been, 9 years in the Navy. I've got to tell you, my experience tells me, and logic tells you, you can't sit back and have a nation threaten you with nukes.
Well, the last threat you wish you'd watched and paid attention to is the one that kills you. I mean, that's the problem. And the likelihood of North Korea launching a missile at, say, Los Angeles and succeeding is remote. But it's the weird chance, it's the outside chance, that you can't deny. And I think what the Obama administration is going to have to do is make sure that we have our defenses to intercept anything that the North Koreans put up in the air. It'll be a test of our defense systems. But again, I think you're right, George. With North Korea taking these bellicose steps towards South Korea and under the new leadership of this young leader, this Kim Jong-un, again, North Korea is on a very dangerous path that's going to have to be contained. Whether the United Nations can impose sanctions and get any benefit, I think, is doubtful. But again, we've got another rogue nation in North Korea on the warpath, making threats that have to be taken seriously.
Now, what if we do this? Let's send former basketball star Dennis Rodman back to North Korea. Let him slap Kim in the back of the head and say, "What are you doing?"
Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, Dennis Rodman had an admirable career in the NBA, but the international politics here, you've got North Korea, which is abusing its own population, the human rights violation, the starvation. This is a very dangerous regime that has militarized to the nth degree. Its military is impressive and dangerous. And South Korea is now on alert, worrying whether North Korea will launch an attack on South Korea, which is not out of the question.
No, and I got to ask you this quick question. A Russian military official says that the body of Hugo Chavez should be looked at and checked because he thinks maybe the United States injected him with some kind of cancer.
Well, again, this is another, a far out and bizarre concern. Hugo Chavez has had cancer for a long time. They've done everything they could in Venezuela to try to cure him, including sending him to
Cuba
and other places to get medical treatment. I think it's, again, a very far out and bizarre idea that the United States injected Hugo Chavez with cancer. But again, you're dealing with radical regimes that have bizarre ideas, and we have to take it seriously. It's going to be very interesting to see how Venezuela adopts to Hugo Chavez being gone and whether or not the regime now becomes more moderate.
That's right. Good point. Jerry, thanks. And what's new with you, by the way? Let me ask you that. I didn't ask you on your last time. Anything?
Oh, I've got a couple of books coming out, George, and I've got a book on the ACLU and the War Against God coming out in April.
Good. All right, we'll get you on the show.
I've got a book coming out on the election, and quickly, I plan to do something on the Kennedy assassination for November.
Okay, well, we'll probably get you in April. We'll get you back in November, plus all the little times in between.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, Jerry Corsi. So a lady in Lady Lake, Florida, decides that she wants to go after the devil. She wants to fight the devil. So what she do? She's a homeless woman. She gets an aluminum bat. She goes into a church, and she beheads a statue in the church because she claimed it was the devil. Well, she's been arrested. They've taken her away. Facebook wants to cut out some clutter. The social media site, which has more than a billion users, has announced a newly redesigned news feed that blows up photos and visual content and adds categories that focus on specific types of content. The web version of the social network now looks much like the mobile apps, which are also getting a revamping. Facebook needing to change a little bit to keep up with the times. Russian scientists have claimed the discovery of a new type of bacterial life in water from a buried Antarctic lake, the Lake Vostok. Last year, the team drilled almost 4 kilometers through ice to reach the lake and retrieve samples. So they think they found something new on planet Earth. In Florida, look for this spring and summer mosquitoes 20 times the size of a normal mosquito, as big as a quarter. That's because of all the floodwaters from tropical storms. They got problems there. Up next, we talk about the brain magic too, and creativity from another dimension. Neil Slade joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Neil Slade with us. Split show for you tonight. So Neil's with us for a couple hours talking about some of his latest work, Brain Magic 2, and of course, Creativity from Another Dimension by Julia Liu. Also, this is a double book. Neil, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you, George?
Good. Doing fine. You know, I get a kick every time we have another guest on who starts talking about the amygdala. I think about you because it was you who taught us about it. I had no idea what that thing was until you started telling us.
Yes. You know, the past 10 years, we've seen a lot more attention, but I think I started writing about it back in 1989, where I don't think 1 in 10,000 people had even heard of the amygdala, much less knew what it did.
It's in there, the old reptilian brain.
Yeah, I call it the brain's master click switch, but what we do is we tickle the amygdala. That's where the fun is at, when you can consciously and deliberately kind of tickle those buttons in your brain, and all sorts of wonderful brain magical things happen when you do that.
So tell me about Brain Magic 2. What's new?
Well, you know, this book originally I wrote about 12 years ago, and it was set up to be a series of exercises where people could consciously and deliberately increase things like pleasure, creativity, and things like paranormal sensitivity, ESP, telepathy. And I had put together at the time a simple guide with, I guess it was about 28 little games that you could play back then. And over these past dozen years or so, I've come across a lot, I've learned a lot more myself about the human brain. And consequently, myself and people I've come in contact with, we've come up with a lot more exercises and games so people could turn on those things.
There's nothing like an imagination to really get things going. And why is it, Neil, that some people have a much vivid, you know, imagination, so much more than somebody else?
I think it's imagination is something that occurs in the more advanced parts of your brain. It's abstract thinking. When you can sense something or see something or hear something that is beyond your senses, in the same way that paranormal senses are beyond the 5 senses that you have. For example, your 5 normal senses would be taste, smell, touch, hearing, and what's the 5th one there? And taste, touch, smell, hearing, and it escapes me. It's a mental
vision.
And vision, that's right. That's so funny. I have to laugh. The brain expert can't think of the five senses. Anyway, so those are your five normal senses. But then you have five paranormal senses that exist inside your head, as it were. And that would be telepathy, that would be precognition, that would be clairvoyance, clairaudience, and telekinesis. Even though telekinesis is not strictly a sense, it's an ability. So you've got telepathy, which is knowing what somebody thinks without any direct communication. Precognition, of course, is knowing what's going to happen before you get there. Clairvoyance is seeing something that you can't see with your physical eyes. Clairaudience would be hearing something that you can't hear with your physical ears. And then telekinesis is the ability to move objects without actually touching them. So these are very advanced functions of the brain. And the advanced functions of the brain typically are things that we learn. We learn from our parents, or we learn from our teacher, or we're exposed to, out there in the real world. And so if you have the right teacher, if you're exposed to the right thing, your ability to imagine in the more traditional sense, as well as these more advanced senses, that's something that you learn. And if you're deprived of those experiences or that exposure, you're just not as good about it. So that's why I wrote, that's what's been the kind of focus of my work this past few years, both in the Brain Magic 2 book and the other novel, The Book of Wands, is to kind of help people learn how they can develop their imagination so it works at much better levels for, better brain function, better problem solving, and that sort of thing.
If you have a vivid imagination, generally you'll probably be more creative, won't you?
Oh, yes. I mean, they're tied. Creativity comes from the imagination. Everything from inventions to our form of government all started as an idea that someone just imagined in their head. And that's where all creativity comes from, is your imagination. And it's, for me and for many other people, imagination is the most powerful ability of your brain and the most powerful and, without question, one of the most important processes that happen in between your two ears.
Well, I think so, too. Now, let's tie it into, as you mentioned, paranormal ESP experiences. How does that work?
Well, as I defined these paranormal experiences of telepathy and telekinesis and so on and so forth, they all start with an abstract thought. They all start with thinking of something that is not in front of us, not directly in front of our two eyes. You've got to imagine something first before you start turning on these paranormal types of abilities. Lots of examples, a couple of excellent examples, right from your show, from Coast to Coast. Way back when, in 1997, we had a problem, and the problem was, and we've talked about this before, but it's a good example. There were fires in northeastern Florida. They had drought for many months, no rain, no significant rain was predicted, and the fires were burning up the state. So I thought this would be a good experiment that we could do on the air. And we had all the listeners start out by imagining what would happen if it rained 10 inches in Florida. And we picked 10 inches because the Weather Service was saying, well, if we got 10 inches of rain, that would put out the fires. So in our brain mass control experiment that we did on Coast to Coast, we started from the imagination. We tickled these kind of the key buttons in the brain, the amygdala buttons, and then I said, imagine it raining in the northeast corner of Florida.
And
so that's what turned the key and got the whole ball rolling.
We're probably responsible for these quarter-sized mosquitoes that are going to pop up this spring. You never know. Neil, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more with you about imagination and the brain. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Neil Slade. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, how about a Coast to Coast birthday wish to you, Matt, from Garden City, South Carolina. Happy 29th for you, and thanks for listening to Coast to Coast AM. Wishing you many, many more. That's from your friends, by the way, in your neck of the woods. And welcome back, Neil Slade, with us for a couple hours. Neil, why are some people not creative? Why are some people without an imagination? How does that happen?
This is mostly due to a part of the brain that is inactive. Now, the imagination happens all over the brain. It's not localized. It works like memory. We know this from brain scans. Imagination can take a lot of different forms. For example, if you're using your visual imagination, this may show up as activity in the occipital lobe, which is in the back part of your brain. If you're using a auditory type of imagination, that activity will happen in a different part of your brain. So imagination is very complex. Some types will happen in certain areas, other types will happen in other places. But primarily, imagination is happening in the outer layers of the brain, what's called the primate brain or the neocortex, the more advanced layers of the brain. And your imagination, when you're talking about positive imagination,
mm-hmm.
occurs when you're relaxed, when you're not feeling threatened. Okay, the kind of
it seems to work better that way.
Yeah, you know, it's an advanced function of the brain. So what we do know is the imagination turns off when you feel threatened, and that's where the amygdala comes into play. When you click into fight or flight, when you're scared, it turns off the neocortex to a great degree, and you click backward into your reptile brain, what you were talking about earlier, and you go into this stressed out, in the moment only, and you don't see more than a few inches in front of your nose. So either if you are habitually stressed out or habitually feel threatened, that will turn off your imagination. So one of the first keys to getting a better imagination is to allow yourself to tickle forward out of this heightened state of threat or fight or flight. And people who are habitually clicked backward into that reptile brain, they have a lot of trouble turning on their imagination.
If they bump their heads or if they're injured, does that affect the outcome of the brain too?
Well, sure, because your first reaction when you talk about an injury is to attend to the moment that you're in. And of course, you can have brain injury. For example, we're all familiar with the very famous case of Phineas Gage. He was the fellow that had the railroad spike driven through his forehead, and that separated his frontal lobes, that forward part of the neocortex, from the rest of his brain. And he lost his imagination. He could not visualize something that was not right in front of his two eyes and right in front of him. So it's very important to maintain this state of, you know, for positive imagination and positive creativity, is to be able to tickle your brain into where you feel comfortable and that you're not worried or that you're not preoccupied with a injury or fear that you're going to be injured or hurt in some way.
Why are some people, though, more intuitive than others? Is it the brain or is it something outside of that, like, you know, consciousness?
Well, you know, as a brain guy, my focus has always been on the physical aspect. How does the physicality of the brain, how do certain processes that we know about in the brain contribute to creativity or to this access of paranormal sensitivities? So I'm always looking for something that is that we can look at the science of, that we've got real hard physical proof of. And so my concern is not so much what lies outside of brain function, but what we know of in brain function that we can say, oh, that contributes to creativity, or that contributes to telepathy. And what is that process actually going on in the brain? I think there's a lot of guesswork out there, and I don't mind it so much, but I like to see proof. I like to see someone who's really looked for the hard evidence for different things and says, well, we know that creativity is enhanced by cooperative behavior. And we can look at the brain scan and people who have a good imagination, and we can say, oh, this is linked to this area of the brain, and so on and so forth. So that's my main concern, is what can we as individuals do that, you know, is beyond just guessing about what might be, you know, that's more than just purely faith-based, or, you know, purely something that we're kind of guessing at.
When people are in a groove and they just know it, you know, whatever they do, they just know they're in the groove. Does the brain have something to do with that?
Oh yeah, sure. And I've always looked for the causes of that. You know, what is that? One person calls it the flow, right? I don't recall his name, but he calls it being in the flow. And that's when everything...
Or the zone.
Or in the zone, yeah. That's another term that's used. So over the years, and for me, this started back in 1989. I wanted, you know, I had just gotten out of college, and I was looking for, you know, a job. I wanted to know how I was going to support myself. And I wanted to get in the zone. I wanted to get in the flow. And so I started looking at brain science. And back then, we didn't call it the zone or the flow, but it was the same thing. We were talking about the same thing. So I tried a lot of different things personally, and I knew a lot of people. I did yoga, and I taught yoga for some time, and I finally ran across a guy who ran a behavior modification lab here in Colorado, TD Lingo. And he called it, his facility, the Dormant Brain Lab. And what he said is, we now know how the human brain works, and we can, with good success and the ability to repeat the success, we know what you can do to help you, in today's terms, get into the flow. And so he had a series of exercises, and you would go up, and you'd spend 6 weeks in the Brain and Nature Camp, and you do all these exercises that would enhance your ability to get into the zone and get to those, you know, get those things done in life that you're trying to get done. And his method, not based on religion, not based on merely positive thinking, but based on looking at what was known about the brain and then doing those things that we knew would enhance those types of brain processes. And what I liked about him and what I liked about the work at the Brain Lab is that it was very broadly based. It wasn't just one thing, because we didn't cut anything out. We looked, and I worked with him for 11 years.
That's a long time, Neil.
It was an awful long time, and I got to know him very well, and I got to know the public side of him and his work, but I also got to know the inside that the public didn't see. So I felt like I really had the truth of, you know, what his process was and the real results that people were having. And but he looked at all kinds of things. He looked at neurology, he looked at the field of positive thinking like Dale Carnegie.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at the Eastern philosophies and yoga and meditation. He looked at drugs and the use of drugs. He looked at the educational system, and all these different things. He had a very global view of the brain and how it worked. And I've tried, for myself, I've tried to maintain that global view of things. And so when I write about the brain and when I design exercises and games, I try not to exclude anything. And I try to say, well, the brain works best when you use the whole brain. You have a right and a left leg. And the best way to walk is you step forward with the left leg, and then you switch sides completely, and you step forward with the right leg. And you do one thing, and then you do just the opposite. And I found over the years, the brain works in exactly the same way. You have certain skills and processes that utilize nonverbal types of processes, things that utilize music, things that utilize art and visual, things that are nonverbal, like I said. And then you've got things that you do which are just the opposite, left brain types of activities that consist of perhaps reading and math and linear thought and analyzing and focusing on a very small piece. That's what the left brain does. But the right brain does just the opposite. It looks at the whole big picture, and it has a much fuzzier view of things. And I think the real key to success with the human brain is this concept of whole brain use, and to go do one thing and then try just the opposite. And by combining those two things, both left and right brain, positive and negative, yin and yang, your brain works twice as good as if you tend to stick with one thing that you're comfortable with.
How important is sleep, Neil, to all of us?
Sleep is very important to the brain. You can't function without a certain amount of sleep. And people are different. Some people require more sleep. Some people require less. You have to kind of know yourself. But as a general rule, most humans need between 6 and 9 hours of sleep every night. And if you get less than what is your optimum amount of sleep, your brain starts working worse and worse. And it's, the longer you go without sufficient sleep, the worse your brain works.
And what do you need, about 6 hours?
Oh, who, me?
Anybody, generally.
People are going to need between 6 and 9 hours. Some people even a little bit more. Most people can't get by with less than 6 hours. Average is between like 7 and 9 hours.
Is there something wrong with someone who sleeps longer than that on a regular basis?
As a general rule, you probably could make that observation. Yeah, if you're sleeping more than that, there's either a physical problem or there's a mental thing going on that's causing a lot of stress that requires you to, to make up that sleep. You'll get, if you're sleeping more than 9-10 hours, then you need to find out what that issue
right.
is. And it's not going to be good for your brain to spend more time in bed.
No, not at all. And if, assuming you don't have sleep apnea, what then causes somebody to just sleep like that? I mean, I've known some people who've been in bed all day, Neil. They can't get out.
Yes. Well, a couple nights ago, I went a whole night without sleep. And so what you do is you end up with a sleep debit, as it were, and then you have to make that up. But usually that sleep debit is paid off within a day or two, and then you're back to your regular sleep patterns. But scientists know that there are very serious implications to lack of sleep. You're going to have memory loss. You're going to have a decrease in fine motor function and in gross motor function. So it's very important to get the right kind of sleep. And sleep that is not dependent upon sleep aids or drugs, a normal type
point.
Of rest, yeah.
What about melatonin?
Melatonin is a naturally occurring hormone within the brain, and it's it's related, it's secreted at certain times, and it's also secreted in relationship to exposure to light. So for humans who are not nocturnal, who are daytime creatures, when the lights become dimmer in the evening, we have a natural response to that, which is a release of melatonin, and that helps us to fall asleep at night. And so melatonin has been found to be an effective sleep aid for many people with minimal side effects. Although I have to tell you, I'm allergic to it. I can't take melatonin because if I do, I get very bad headaches.
I tried it once a long time ago, I think 50 milligrams. Bizarre dreams, Neil.
Oh, yes. Yes. And, you know, it occurs to me, and I won't state this as fact, but I do believe the melatonin is related to the pituitary gland, which is in the center of the brain. And the pituitary gland is connected to our exposure to light as well, and that light exposure will cause a release of certain hormones. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But the pituitary gland also has been found to be connected to the manufacture of dimethyltryptamine in the brain. And although they don't know exactly what the function of dimethyltryptamine is, the short-term initials for that being DMT, we do know that DMT is an extraordinarily strong chemical that causes the most vivid hallucinations of any known psychoactive substance. So there may be a tie between melatonin, the pituitary gland, and DMT, and what you are personally reporting to as very intense dreams.
Dreams.
Yeah.
That is something. Give us your websites, Neil.
Brainradar.com is one that everyone can spell. And I've put a couple of links up just for listeners tonight. One is Brain Radar Week, which is proof of brain radar working. And then it's got the links to all the books and so on. But brainradar.com will take you to the website and to all the goodies that are there.
Tell me a little bit about Julia Liu.
Well, this is a kind of an interesting story because it has to do with Coast to Coast. Many years ago, I had gone to my mailbox, and there was a unexpected big brown envelope in there. And I opened it up, and there was a 1-inch thick manuscript in Chinese, handwritten Chinese characters. And the address said Julia Liu, Columbia, Missouri. And you're originally from Missouri too, aren't you?
St. Louis area.
Yeah, all right. So I didn't know anybody in Columbia, and I had no idea what. So I'm flipping through this Chinese stuff, which of course I can't read at all. And suddenly I realize it's my book. It was the book called The Frontal Lobe Supercharged. That I wrote.
She just rewrote it for you.
She had translated the entire book into handwritten Chinese. So we started emailing and phoning, and finally she started visiting. And I ended up marrying Julia Liu.
No.
And I did.
Great
yes.
story.
So we got married on 11/11/2011.
Great story. Neil, stay with us. We're at the break. We're going to come back, take some phone calls with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM.